That's it. Let's keep on pushing, pardon me, the impressions. Joining us now is Norman Otis Richmond. Are you there, Norman?
Yes, sir. How are you?
Very good. Great to be talking to you. I know there's a book going to be coming out that you and others are hard at work on, and touching on the matters of your life and music and politics. I want to just, and our listeners are always curious about how you developed into all your positions and the accomplishments that you had.
Phil, but I'm having problems hearing you.
Okay, I'll tell you what, we'll take a break on, we'll call you back and get a good line, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm still on the air, I think, and we'll check with Norman. Okay. On that point, we were speaking of earlier. Well, I'll tell you what. Let me stay on Norman just for a moment because I want to tell people why he's a very important guy in Toronto movements against racism and against apartheid in South Africa. He's a major figure. People don't, you know, they sort of know, but we really need to get it fleshed out of the effort that was made and led by people like Norman. And he was close to a good friend of ours, Charles Roach, and many others, and he'll name them. But not only did Norman has had a great career in fighting racism, and he's a very class conscious advocate. But he's also quite accomplished musician, and I've listened to the man sing. He's a great singer, and he's been members of groups and whatnot. So I think we're going to try again. We're going to see how this goes. So are you there, Norman?
Yes, sir. I can hear you a little bit, but yeah, let's work with it.
We will do our best. You can always give a speech. Don't be afraid. I mean, if you can't, we hear you. So anyhow, look, I want to know what anybody would ask. As a young person, you grew up, my understanding, in California, in Southern California, L.A. area. Well, when did you, in your household, begin to develop a kind of a clear political idea of who the leaders of should be in America and what the problems were?
When I was younger, I think I was like everyone else. I was Martin Luther King, and at that particular point, I thought Martin Luther King was next to God. And then, you know, at one point, I actually turned against Dr. King. And years later, I fell in love again with Dr. King.
Well, did the turning have anything to do with Malcolm X?
It had a lot. It was all about Malcolm X and the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But I when I was 14 years old, I was going to John C. Fremont High School, and there was a guy by the name of Charles Wright, and Charles Wright was a member of Bunchy Carter's street organization, the Slawsons, and Bunchy Carter had a subgroup of the Slawsons called the Renegade Slawsons, and Charles Wright was a guy. He had an automobile. He was one of the best dressed, if not the best dressed person at the school, and he was known for being able to defend himself. Like I say, he had the most beautiful women in the car and all of that. And what had happened was
there's a leader.
And what had happened was they had killed Patrice Lumumba and Maurice Mpolo and Joseph Okito. It was on January 17th, 1961. Uh-huh. And I was I don't remember if it made that much impressions on me in terms of at that particular point, all I know is that this guy, Charles Wright, he was making fun of the names. He was referring to, he was talking about, he was trying to say Cassie Voo Voo, but he referred to him as Cassie Boo Boo. And he was basically rejoicing that Lumumba, Joseph Okito, and Maurice Mpolo were killed. And that didn't sit too well with me.
He must have lost a lot of followers with that.
Oh, I don't know what he lost. All I know, but there was a young guy, and he was looking at me, and he was in a stairwell, and he looked at me, and he says, "Young brother," he was the same age as I was. But he says, "I'm looking at you, and it looks like you're really upset at this guy talking. He's talking crazy." And he says, "Would you like to hear the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad?" And I was like, "Who? What? You know?" So I says, "I'm good." So he came and picked me up and took me to 5606 Broadway. It was a temple at that time, Temple 27. And I heard a young man by the name of he just passed away recently. His name was Allah Akbar Muhammad. But at that time, he was John Shabazz. And he was out of, I did some research on him. He was born in Arkansas, but he was out of St. Louis. And he helped, he and Malcolm X, they started, he helped Malcolm X start the Muhammad Speaks and so on and so forth. But he sounded just like Malcolm, or Malcolm sounded like him. Mm-hmm. And I heard him talk, and I never will forget. I was 14 years old, and I remember one of the first things he said was, what did a black man contribute to civilization? And he said, civilization itself. I started listening to the teachings, and then I started running track, and I started singing, and I moved away. That was 1961.
Did you attend?
I got into my teenage stuff. So yeah. I started singing and I started running track. I was good at track, and I was pretty good. I was a pretty good singer. And
you ran in the relays in the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum.
Yes, sir.
One of the great spots, athletic places in the world, and you were on the. A winning team, were you not, or at least a contender? What was that?
Oh no! What happened? Well, I ran the 50 yard dash, and I hate to. I had a very good start, but I had a very bad day. To be honest with you, I don't think that I got out of the heat, but I ran the first leg on the relay, and one of the members of the relay was Willie Crawford. Now Willie Crawford went on to play. For the Los Angeles, he signed with the L.A. Dodgers when he was right straight out of high school.
Well, he was also a state sprint champion, wasn't he?
Beg your pardon?
Wasn't he a state sprint champion?
Willie Crawford was a football player, baseball player, track star. He was he was one of the greatest athletes to come out of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. When I ran the first leg on the relay, and I must admit, I did my job. The second man did his job, third man did his job, and he and Willie dropped the baton.
That's it.
My mother and father.
Heartbreaking thing to watch a relay team because it's got to work. The handoff has to work. If it doesn't, the most beautiful relay team just falls apart.
That's right, and I remember.
Go ahead.
Mother and father were sitting in the stands, and I was very, 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 very disappointed. But
well, you didn't drop the baton.
Oh no! I didn't know. I did my job because I had a start like Justin Gatlin or Coleman. I was notorious. They put me. I ran the first leg. I was the second fastest on the team, but I was noted for having coming out of the box.
Yeah.
I could beat anybody in 50 yards.
In terms of relation to politics, it's certainly true, isn't it, that black American athletes with any degree of success are expected or it's understood that they're eventually going to take some kind of position on how Black Americans are treated. And we have all these names, Alcindor and Jim Brown and, of course, Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali. The moment there's success, it's understood, and it really should be celebrated, how many of them courageously challenged the racial system.
Well, I agree. Beginning with even before Jack Johnson, but let's begin with Jack Johnson. But Jack Johnson was so. I think Jack Johnson had a relationship with the Rasputin in the Soviet Union. Jack Johnson had relationships with people in Mexico, you know. But Jack Johnson's problem with the system was that he had. Euro-American girlfriends, and this is in the 20s now,
yeah,
in the teens and in the 20s, and and he was not there was a myth that said he used to go to Ku Klux Klan rallies. I think that's an urban myth. I know he was a tough guy. I don't think he was that tough, but that was one of the things that the systems.
Arthur Ashe was very well read,
well traveled,
right,
and very well spoken.
Arthur Ashe, you remember, wrote a history of Black athletes in sport politics and struggle against racism. He said the most important Black athlete in American history was Jack Johnson, because a fight. The heavyweight fight is kind of the moment, right? That's the test. And Jack Johnson defeated the great white champion. And that caused riots. People were killed in the riots because white America was so shocked. It's just an amazing story. By the way, I can't resist mentioning, you remember when John McCain, senator from Arizona, who admired Jack Johnson, he went to Obama, president of the United States, and asked him to pardon Jack Johnson, and he didn't do it. And then he went to Trump, and Trump did it.
Yes, yes.
I mean, these are kind of important stories, not that they tell us, they surprise you. And you wonder about Americans and what goes on in their minds because of the insanity of racism. I better ask you.
I want to say one other thing about Jack Johnson. I think it was a king. He was in Kenya, some place in East Africa, and they asked him about Black people in the West, America, in the Western Hemisphere, and he said they only two people of African origin that he knew were Marcus Mosiah Garvey and Jack Johnson. That was because they carried the seamen carried the. I guess he heard about those two people through reading the Negro World.
Yes.
Marcus Garvey's the UNIA and African Communities League, newspaper.
Yeah. That he actually he occupied as much space, and was as profoundly influential as Muhammad Ali. Because it's just like a lightning bolt in the dark. It was this amazing story.
But Muhammad Ali said that Jack Johnson was more militant than he was.
Yeah, well, we know he flaunted. He did not care. He was from the South. He was from Texas. And they said all his life he just did what he wanted to do. And that means every day of his life he was in danger of being killed because the mores and the laws were entirely against the kind of conduct that Jack Johnson went about doing anyway. He ignored others. It's just a tremendous example. But moving from that, I want to make sure we get this. When did you begin to take part in actual demonstrations or go to begin to join organizations after you mentioned you were 14, you saw the Muhammad Speaks people. Did you get involved in civil rights demonstrations in Los Angeles, that kind of thing?
I remember I was part of a group called the United Front, and it was like a study group, and we demonstrated against a Black Power conference. Mm-hmm. We demonstrated against the Black Power because we were kind of we considered ourselves to the left of them, and we came outside and they ran us away with pistols. Mm-hmm. So as Marcus Garvey said, we had to get in the whirlwind, but a lot of those people later on came over to our position.
Yeah. Yeah, those are tough moments. Now, you mentioned some of those names that I was here became Black Panthers, right? Did they not?
I used to be with Masai Hewitt, Raymond Masai Hewitt. He was the Minister of Education for the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped me get out of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I knew Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a Los Angeles City College with him.
With Bunchy? Well,
Bunchy was 4 years older than I was, and he spent a lot of time in the, he was in prison and in juvenile facilities. So a lot of time he was away from us. But Bunchy joined the Nation of Islam when he was 14.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a lot of, he influenced us.
Mm-hmm. I know that you were interested in a movement that would be international. Would you use the term Pan-Africanist? Are you comfortable being called a Pan-Africanist?
A Pan-Africanist, African Internationalist, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the people that I work with, they consider a Pan-Africanism like a reformist organization. I don't necessarily go that far.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of people that I move with, they see me as William Everett Burkhard Du Bois as an Uncle Tom. I don't subscribe to that.
Yeah. There's a lot of name calling. I remember Richard Nixon attacked the Communist Party of the USA. He said, they're trying to lure American youth by calling themselves the Boys Club. He didn't know it was D-U-B-O-I-S, Du Bois.
Yeah, but you know, I was born in Louisiana, and Marcus Garvey's biggest followers was in Louisiana, and I was really influenced by Garvey.
Mm-hmm. By the way, were you your views on these individuals? And I got to tell you, mine are the same. That sometimes it was positive, sometimes negative. But you've come in later years to really mark the importance of Marcus Garvey as one of the most successful and most able leaders, right?
Marcus Mosiah Garvey, yes, he created the biggest largest organization. I don't know if anybody has surpassed that yet.
Hmm. He seemed to have, I don't know if maybe you could answer this. He had a capacity for organization. I've looked at some of his writings. He was what they call a detail man. If you were going to have a meeting, it had to start at a certain time, things had to be set. The talks had to have limited time, and then they would close. And he would tell people exactly how to do it. He didn't leave any margin of error, right?
Oh yeah, he had manuals on how to do everything. Like he even told people that you know, if you're sitting at a bus stop or any, you have a moment, always have something to read. Always have something to read.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you you are known and really should be celebrated for the leadership role you took in on anti-apartheid, where you mixed your experience as a both a musician and an authority on blues. You've known many artists, and you put together with others an anti-apartheid organization based on black artists, right? Could you talk about that?
We started a group called the Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition after Stephen Biko, Walter Rodney, and Malcolm X. And we had people from North America, Canada, United States, the Caribbean, and Africa. And we gave awards to people that had refused to perform in South Africa, and we demonstrated against those who had gone to South Africa.
Which artists gave you, you know, sort of said, Norman, you got to do this, and I'm going to support you? So who were some of these people?
One of our biggest supporters was a guy named Jason, John Perez from Trinidad. He's no longer in the land of the living, but he actually did a song called South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We gave awards to the Mighty Sparrow. I don't know if we gave Peter Tosh an award, but I had a very close relationship with Walde Semyat, aka Winston Hubert McIntosh. Yeah.
Mm.
And Jane Cortez. Jane Cortez went to the same high school I went to, John C. Fremont, although she went there 10 years before. And Don Cherry, he went there, the great John Cherry, not to be confused with the hockey man Don Cherry, the Canadian guy.
Yeah, he wasn't in the forefront.
No. He was in the forefront on the right wing.
Yeah, he's a leader of the opposite. Now, and what you were calling for, by the way, was, I mean, it took courage. People like Harry Belafonte and others, they said, boycott, don't go there. And South Africa was offering big bucks, a lot of money, for if the black artists would come to give them a kind of veneer, right?
Right.
And who were, the name that always comes to mind is Belafonte, but talk about who the people you most admired and who participated in a boycott.
I think you had two wings. You had Randall Robinson, Harry Belafonte. They did a lot of work around that. But then there was a radical set of people led by Ilombe Brass, Ron Wilkins, and Ron Wilkins was from Los Angeles, and Kumasi was from Los Angeles, and we had our group here in Toronto, and we would we used to give Ray Charles the blues. Like, if he came to Los Angeles, we'd hit him. He came to Los Angeles, Ilombe would hit him. We came to Toronto, we would hit him. There was a white group, or a Euro-American group out of Albany, New York. Mm-hmm. If he went through Albany, New York, they would get him. And there was a group in St. Louis. They went through St. Louis. They would get him in St. Louis. So we had it. It was coordinated.
Do you think, by the way, you ever put a dent in him? He was a very interesting individual. We know that he famously put you in the history books by telling you, who was he talking to when he made a disparaging comment about you?
Oh yeah, he said that you can tell Norman Richmond and his Black Music Association that he can kiss the rear end of my posterior. But Ray Charles was a man that I loved. I used to be able to sing his songs backwards. They called him the Secretary of State. And I loved his music. Loved him. Loved his music to death.
Yeah. And he knew that. I mean, just a tragic. But by the way, he had a predecessor that, and isn't it true that he imitated at the beginning of his career? He imitated Nat King Cole.
Oh, without a doubt.
And there was another guy who, don't you think their philosophy was, I'm going to do this, I'm going to be a success, and that'll be my. Of course, I enrich myself, but you know, it was both of them faced a lot of problems with race, but Nat King Cole was. You remember, was attacked on the stage, right?
He tried in Birmingham, Alabama. They jumped on stage and beat him up, right?
And he was a guy who just said, "I'm just here. I do my songs," and still they attacked him.
I was a huge fan of Nat King Cole. Yeah. I actually met his. I met both of his daughters, but one of his daughters, I think, was Carol. She was, I think, they adopted her, mm-hmm. And I remember spending some time with her. She liked my politics.
Uh-huh. This is the daughter of Nat King Cole.
So this was what had happened. I think Nat's wife. Had a sister that passed away, and that raised, adopted Carol Cole, right?
Yeah. You know, at the top of the show, we played a song that I know you think is important to the movement, "Keep On Pushing." The Impressions, Curtis Mayfield. Did you know Curtis Mayfield, and what was his contribution?
Curtis Mayfield was called the gentle giant. His contribution was he made songs that were that dealt with that helped move the struggle forward.
Mm-hmm.
And he made one big mistake. He performed in South Africa, but he cleaned that up. He really cleaned that up. Mm-hmm. But he was a big supporter of Jesse Jackson, Martin Luther King, and I think he quietly supported Malcolm, uh-huh. And he met with Angela Davis when Angela was in prison. He met. I don't think it wasn't a secret, but he had a relationship with the entire movement, even the left.
Mm-hmm. And James Brown, he really had impact. His Black and Proud, et cetera. They became anthems, those songs.
James Brown was a complex guy because a lot of times he supported the movement, and many times the system used him if they could get him to say something to cool people down. They would try to use him,
mm-hmm.
But he was kind of all over the place. Mm-hmm. But I think his heart was in the right place.
What do you think of the songs?
I Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud.
Yeah, his material when he tried to address these issues. What did you make of that in the songs?
Oh, I was the biggest big even he was singing. American songs. The songs were so funky. I had to secretly tap my feet to them. But mm-hmm. I might have been James Brown's biggest fan.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen him about 25 times.
You saw him six? How many times?
At least 25.
Wow. Nobody could sit down during a performance of James Brown, could they?
No. Oh, no.
Impossible. Looking back, I want to something you and I talked about. The names now, and they were already becoming monuments, and they've named streets after Malcolm and after Martin Luther King, and that process continues. But there were other names, and one of the names that you told me about was Mae Mallory. And also you had thoughts about Rosa Parks. Can you talk about that?
Rosa Parks was one of the women that refused to sit on the back of the bus. And she was more left-wing than the system was basically trying to tone her down.
Yeah, she was just a nice little woman in the bus, right?
And I think that Rosa had some economic problems, and there was I don't know who it was, but somebody looked after her until she passed away. But she was close to the left, mm-hmm. and Mae Mallory was I think she was out of Georgia, and she came to New York, and she was involved with Robert Franklin Williams, the man who wrote Negroes with Guns, and he lived in Cuba and China and Tanzania. Mm-hmm. And Mae Mallory, she moved to Tanzania. She lived in East Africa for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a, what would you call it, uncut, straight no chaser revolutionary.
Yeah. And she was recognized by all these other figures. They knew her. What organization did she, who was her closest associate?
Something tells me she might have been in the Workers' World Party. I might be wrong.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Rosa Parks. I saw a picture, which I wish everybody would see, of Rosa Parks with Robert Williams.
Yeah. She was at Robert Williams' funeral. I think she wore a Mao. I wouldn't say a uniform, but the Mao jacket and mm-hmm. a hat.
If they're going to make a monument, as they do to people like Rosa, and they like to have the moment, frankly, that ought to be a museum, and those pictures should be there so that people would know that she was a full-blown human being with a bunch of opinions that motivated her and kept her going, right?
You can probably Google image and see that photo of Rosa Parks in her Chairman Mao outfit.
Mm-hmm. Well, Robert Williams got everybody's attention. He must have when you heard about him, it must have been electric, right? You heard about this guy in North Carolina who was confronting the Klan. He was an ex-Marine, Robert Williams.
Oh yeah, but the thing about Robert Williams was the place where he came to Canada, and he lived in Canada until they did a story in the Globe and Mail and put his picture on the front page. And I actually went to the house where he stayed,
mm-hmm.
the Olson's house. I remember going out there with my son, and
we had to put a plaque there.
Mr. Olson and his wife, they were followers of Leon Trotsky, and it's my understanding, you know, that they had to take Walter, but they had to take. Robert, this phone is going back and forth, so I'm having a problem. But Robert Williams, the Trotskyites and the Communist Party formed an alliance, took him from Toronto to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and he got on a boat and went to Cuba.
And that's... Isn't that a curious thing? Is that Jack Johnson did the same thing?
Jack, and another thing is that Robert Williams had a publication called The Crusader,
mm-hmm.
it was like a newsletter, and the Olsons used to send it from Cuba to the Olsons, and then people from Detroit would come up, and then they would send a Crusader to Los Angeles, to Detroit. to Philadelphia, St. Louis, and you know we saw it in Los Angeles.
It did make its way around.
And the Crusader, I think the Crusader was a name that got the name from the African Blood Brotherhood's newspaper. The African Blood Brotherhood was a group that fought in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and their leader was one of their leaders was a guy by the name of Cyril Briggs. He was out of St. Kitts, and they left the African Blood Brotherhood, and many of them joined the U.S. Communist Party.
Uh-huh. One of the leaders from the Tulsa massacre.
No, the Tulsa. They fought in Tulsa. They fought against the police.
You know
that.
Are you talking about that moment when they had the actual just a war in Tulsa?
You're right. 1921.
Yeah. You know that they're really going over that site now. They're still finding bodies and documenting. They've done no tests to see who to identify people. They were mass graves.
Right.
I mean, people talk about violent American history. They better look close. I was just looking into a big fight at Carroll, Illinois, which used to be a city. It's now a ghost town. There's no one there. There was war in Carroll, Illinois.
I want to tell you another story about Cyril Briggs, if you have time.
Go ahead.
Well, Cyril Briggs was he had a little problem with melanin. He looked like a European,
mm-hmm.
and he stuttered badly. And they say the only time that he spoke perfect English, Marcus Garvey called him a white man pretending to be black, and he stood on a street corner on the 25th and Lenox Avenue and spoke perfect English and sued Marcus and won.
Where can I find that story? somebody better document that. Let's wind up here with the last one here. You did a lot with Charles Roach, Dudley Laws, that experience and example lives on. Talk about those two guys.
Charles Roach, I can't say anything negative about Charlie. Charlie gave me, he gave my son two baby showers. He used to criticize me because I thought I was a little bit too, he considered me an atheist. And I don't know if Charles was really into the religious thing that much, but but he supported me from the first time I met him until he passed away.
Yeah. Well, but he also was with you folks when Bad Sea was put together, right?
You know, I was not a part of Bad Sea because I was raising I was a single parent raising my. I was a supporter of Bad Sea, but I can't not say that I was mm-hmm. going to meetings and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I was very close to Milton. Milton Blake was my son's godfather, and he and Dudley and my son was he used to fight me all the time. If I said anything negative about Dudley Laws, he would almost want to punch me in the mouth.
Well, that's a good argument.
Yeah, he loved Dudley, and Dudley loved him.
Dudley walked on fire a few times. They made him, I remember they put him through perp walks and everything else, just smeared him, and he kept right on going. And
oh, yeah, I remember.
Very stable leader.
At the end of his life, Dudley warmed up on Cuba, because at one point Dudley was, he wasn't that close on the socialist question.
Uh-huh.
But by the time he passed away, he was Vince Arima's man.
Well, Otis, we really appreciate coming, going over this, and it seems to me we're going to have to do this again to add more names and get history straight. Thank you very, very much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'm glad somebody has recognized our position. When I say our, I mean people, the so-called black radical folks.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you're the walking, talking guy that did it. Thanks very much, Otis.
You're welcome.